Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on this morning's magazine, we'll check in with a Boulder County State Legislator on what they expect to see in the 2020 State Legislative Session. After that, we'll hear about gangs in prisons. It's the subject of a new book by a professor of sociology at CU Boulder. He'll be speaking at the Boulder Bookstore this evening. Then we'll have a brief comment line before we go back to the BBC for headlines. Then it's time for science. And this morning, our guest in studio is Brenda Eck-Wurzel, who is a senior climate scientist and director of climate science for Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She was in town recently for a conference on public health, climate, air quality and ozone. At 9 o'clock, it is Alan Watts running out this morning's news and public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Alejandra Wilcox.
Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebrations spanned the Front Range on Monday, with calls for courage, unity, and action dominating the events. Tens of thousands of people marched in Denver's 35th annual Marade, with many marchers singing and waving placards along Colfax Avenue. One marcher, who lost his left leg in a drive-by shooting, traversed the 3 miles on crutches. He told the Denver Post, "We're here to promote awareness of equality." In Boulder, students, political, and religious leaders gathered on the CU Boulder campus. Newly elected Boulder Councilwoman Junie Joseph pointed to examples of racism still prevalent in Boulder, including her own experiences. She says that emails that refer to her as a token member of city council prove that, quote, Dr. King's dreams have not been fully realized. Joseph encouraged the crowd to stand for those who cannot stand for themselves, with others urging community members to be active participants in their democracy. In downtown Boulder, people gathered for a short rally and then marched to the Dairy Arts Center. The Dairy hosted a performance focused on stories from the criminal justice system. This event was hosted by the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center. State Representative Jonathan Singer of Longmont spoke before the march, calling for people to care for each other regardless of background or party differences. "We can all work together to change things," Singer said. People also gathered for Martin Luther King Day celebrations in Longmont, with about 200 people gathering at Silver Creek High School. In Fort Collins, hundreds of people gathered to honor Dr. King's legacy, marching from Old Town to the CSU campus. Denver police say that they are still investigating a series of armed robberies of metro-area marijuana dispensaries. This latest string of crimes, which all occurred in December 2019, brought the number of break-ins at marijuana businesses to a 3-year high. In 2019, Denver dispensaries reported 5 robberies and 122 burglaries, a slight increase from 2018, according to police. The general counsel for local dispensary Frosted Leaf says that their 3 Denver locations have been burglarized after hours 8 times since 2014. However, on December 3rd, 4 men held 2 Cherry Creek employees at gunpoint. Police believe those suspects are likely linked to 6 other dispensary robberies in the Denver area. A police commander told the Denver Post that marijuana at wholesale price goes for $1,200 per pound in Colorado. However, on the East Coast, that same pound of marijuana is worth as much as $3,500. This kind of crime hasn't always been so prevalent. The rate of burglary was about half as much in 2016 and 2017 as it is today. Following the latest December robbery, Frosted Leaf has increased security, but dispensary employees are worried about another stick-up. Some are even considering leaving the industry because of this threat. Frosted Leaf's general counsel says that as long as the industry is forced to be cash only, these robberies will likely continue. The ongoing federal prohibition of cannabis has led to barriers to banking for businesses in states like Colorado. However, legal marijuana operations may have access to banking services as soon as this year. That's thanks to the recent passage of the Safe Banking Act, which was authored by Colorado Democratic Representative Ed Perlmutter. Colorado campaign headquarters for Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders opened up this past Sunday. That's just over 3 weeks before mail ballots for the March 3rd primary start going out to Colorado voters. Colorado Politics reports that supporters packed the campaign headquarters office as staffers and key endorsers promised a repeat win in Colorado's presidential primary. Back in 2016, Sanders won Colorado's precinct caucuses with roughly 60% of the vote to Hillary Clinton's 40%. This year, semi-open primary will allow unaffiliated voters to cast ballots for the first time. That new rule, along with the crowded field for the Democratic nomination, could complicate Sanders' ability to win Colorado again. Former State Representative Joe Salazar, a Thornton Democrat who was among the first elected officials in Colorado to endorse Sanders in 2016, says the progressive movement has only grown. Salazar also says that progressives have shown the establishment, quote, "Not only are we here, we are the backbone of the party." The state field director told Colorado Politics that around 15,000 volunteers are signed up to work for Sanders in Colorado, adding that they have more volunteers than anyone in Colorado. The campaign also expects an influx of dozens of organizers arriving from Iowa and New Hampshire after those states finish voting in mid-February. Supporters say that the Sanders campaign represents a diverse effort that spans different classes, races, and generations who are here, quote, because they believe in a government that works for the people. The weather today will be mostly cloudy, with highs of around 50 degrees expected. It's currently around 35 degrees here on the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Alejandra Wilcox.
It is 12 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, the state legislative session is in full swing, and it's already seen quite a lot of new bills being introduced as it enters into its third week. But there is a lot more to come. I caught up with State Senator Michael Foote, a Democrat from Lafayette, and I asked him if we're likely to see any legislation around oil and gas regulation in this session.
Well, first of all, there's still a lot of rules that have to be made at the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. They're not even halfway through the rules that we required them to do under last year's law or last year's bill. So there's going to be a lot of action on that level. As far as new laws that are passed for oil and gas, I don't think that's really going to happen this time around. But there's still a lot of action on the administrative level. As far as renewable energy goes or electric vehicles, like you asked, there will be some more bills on those things. One of the bills that I'm looking to run deals with demand side management and making sure to reduce demand for gas and make sure that we account for the cost of methane and cost of extraction for gas and that will help incentivize more demand side management or energy efficiency in plain English. That's something I'm looking at. I'm looking at trying to expand distributed generation, which is basically more solar, more local generation, and incentives for that. And there's maybe some tax policy on board to, again, create more incentives for renewable energy. There's other bills that people are looking at. The Colorado Energy Office is looking at some electric vehicle type of bills, also some beneficial electrification, some building codes. So there's a lot of things that are being discussed, and I think we'll continue to make progress. And that's the goal, is every session we come in, we make more and more progress.
There's so much attention being paid to the COGCC, and particularly in the new rulemaking process. But what about some of the other entities like the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, that also play a role, particularly when it comes to renewable energies, when we're seeing communities like Boulder trying to create their own municipal utility? Should the public be paying attention to what's happening at the PUC, or is there legislation that might be pertaining to that?
You're absolutely right. There's a lot that's done at those agencies like the Public Utility Commission. Also, I will just say the Air Quality Control Commission. There's all of these alphabet soup of agencies that maybe people don't pay as much attention to as they could or should, or don't understand as much as they could. And that's nobody's fault. It's just it's state government. It's alphabet soup. It's not just something that is inherently something you understand necessarily. But there's a lot of action at those agencies. The Public Utilities Commission, we reformed last year as well. It didn't really get that much attention, particularly compared to the oil and gas issue. But we reformed the Public Utility Commission in a pretty interesting way. Lots of reforms to really push them towards accounting for more renewable and pushing for more renewable and giving them more direction from the legislature that they should push for more renewable with utilities and gas providers. And they're starting to implement those things. And we have a good commission that's doing that now. So it's been a sea change, really, at the Public Utilities Commission, but it's definitely flown under the radar. I would say if someone wants to pay attention, then they definitely should, because a lot of good work is being done there and will continue to be done there. And that's where the public can also weigh in and make a difference.
Aside from energy policy, what are some of the big bills that you're really anticipating will generate a lot of debate and that you're really excited to implement at the state legislature in this session?
Well, I think some of the bigger bills that we'll be debating include healthcare bills. You probably know about the fact that we started the process for a public option this last session in 2019, and that's hopefully going to come to fruition in 2020. The insurance industry is already spending millions of dollars of dark money in order to try to get that to not happen, so that's going to continue to be a big debate. Family leave is going to be a big debate as well. That's been something that many legislators have tried to implement over the last several years and will continue to do this year. And that would be a really big deal if it got implemented or if it got passed and later implemented. So those are going to be two big issues. There's always criminal justice reform issues, like death penalty repeal has been recently introduced. And I hear that it seems like it's more likely that there's votes to pass the repeal this year than in the past. So that'll be a debate. Other criminal justice reforms. There's lots of things that are on the table, and it should be a consequential session. I don't think that there'll be quite as many just huge headline-grabbing type of bills like what we had last year. I mean, we just did a lot of really big things last year, the oil and gas reform being just one of them, but still consequential things nonetheless.
One of the big things that a lot of people felt maybe didn't get done last time was transportation and funding for that. Is that something that ultimately you see the voters having to decide on, given the restrictions around Tabor, or do you anticipate some legislation that could tackle some of the infrastructure and transportation issues?
Well, it's something that we are paying attention to. I think our ability to tackle those is pretty limited, as you mentioned, by Tabor. And one of the talking points that's made by some legislators is that you just have to, quote unquote, prioritize what's in the budget. Well, I can tell you that we have done that, and there's not nearly as much money in the budget to give transportation its due. There's going to have to be some kind of a new revenue source, whatever that may be. And there's been three ballot measures now in front of the voters, and the voters have rejected all of them. So I think some people are at a loss about how to do that. But really what it comes down to is what everybody was taught as a kid, which is you can't get something for nothing. And so there's going to have to be additional revenue from somewhere. I know that there's legislation that's being considered to try to create local districts that can raise revenue, for example, if the voters approve, other little tweaks here and there. But it's not going to solve the problem. We have a $9 billion hole in our transportation infrastructure, and we just can't do it with what we have coming in at this point, particularly now this year. We have to do refunds, Tabor refunds, because the revenue that came in exceeds the arbitrary cap that was composed, that was put in there by Tabor. So with all of these issues with our budget and limitations, it just is not there. There just needs to be some other type of creative solution, and hopefully the voters will ultimately approve it. I guess I just have to cross my fingers, because really it's up to the voters and not as much to us.
That's Senator Michael Foote, a state senator who's a Democrat from Lafayette. I caught up with State Senator Foote last Thursday evening as he spoke at a public forum on air quality in Longmont that's connected to fracking. Now, you can find all of our coverage on that online at news.kgnu.org. But do stay tuned, because we're going to have a conversation on air quality that's coming up on How on Earth with the senior climate scientist and director of climate science for climate and energy. This is at the Union of Concerned Scientists. They'll be our guest live in the studio coming up in just about 12 or 13 minutes' time. It is 8:20. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU. David Pyrous is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and his research interests include gangs, criminal networks, incarceration, and offender reentry. And he tackles all of those subjects in his new book that is just out. It's called Competing for Control: Gangs and the Social Order of Prisons. He'll be speaking about that book this evening at the Boulder Bookstore.
I've been interested in prisons for quite some time. You know, there are 1.5 million people who sit in our state and federal facilities. We know big statistics about them. We know about how many are released every year, how many go to prison every year. But a lot of times we miss the picture that's happening behind bars. In other words, pulling back the curtain and actually learning about what life is like in prison.
And one of those statistics I think really we need to pay attention to is, and that is the amount of people that will one day be released. Because prison is not something that's just in isolation. It really is connected to broader society because the vast majority, I think is it 90-95% of people will one day be back in society. So it does seem to behoove us all to pay attention to what they're experiencing when they are behind bars because that could influence so much of what happens when they're no longer in prison.
Absolutely. And there's a misconception. A lot of people think that once someone goes to prison, they stay in prison for the rest of their lives. We call that life without parole or someone who's sentenced to death. And you're right. It's an upwards of 95% of people are ultimately released. And the people in this study, for example, they leave in about 5 years on average.
Well, take us through then some of the folks that you met in the course of studying what's happening in prisons for your new book. It's called Competing for Control, Gangs and the Social Order of Prisons. When people hear that, I think they might think of, you know, some of those big prisons in California that have been the subject of a lot of films and various different things with big gangs in there. But if we're looking just generally at prisons in the US, what is the social order, if we start with that? How is society, for want of a better word, constructed and ordered within the prison by the prisoners themselves?
Yeah, so there's two components of that. One, we talk about the structure, and the second, we talk about the culture. And when we're talking about the structure, we're talking about inmate relations. And there's generally an inmate hierarchy. And there's a lot of speculation about who operates at the top of the hierarchy. And by that, I mean, who has the most influence over other prisoners? Who controls the contraband markets? Who gets to determine where people sit during lunch? And who occupies certain places of the yard and so on? So that's where we're talking about the structural relations. In culture, we're talking about what are the preferences? How is status assigned? What is important behind bars? And there's been a lot of speculation that gangs operate at the top of the hierarchy and that they're the ones who will set the culture in prison. And some speculation about whether that comes from outside of prisons. In other words, does it emerge in our streets and then it's imported into prison? Or is it a reflection of, you know, these deprivations and the administrative control that's brought about by the prison staff itself?
So what did you find then in your research?
Yeah, so we did this large study. This is based in Texas, of a large representative sample of prisoners, 802 of them. We sat down and spent about 2 hours interviewing them to learn about life in prison and how they're preparing to reenter back into the community. About half of these inmates, all of whom were men, were gang members, at least as designated by the prison system, and the other half weren't involved in gangs. So we asked them a lot of questions, open-ended questions, closed-ended questions, because we really wanted to understand the dynamics of life in prison. And one of the big findings that we had out of here is the dynamics of gangs are changing in Texas, for one. For two, it's that gangs do exert a great deal of control behind bars, but it's not this iron-fisted, monolithic control that we have been led to believe. Some of that comes from media reports. Some of that comes from prison officials. Some of that comes from these firsthand autobiographies of prisoners as well.
And do those gangs correlate then to gangs outside of the prison? I mean, if you're in a gang outside of the prison, you will be in that gang when you become a prisoner, or do you join the gang when you become a prisoner?
That, I mean, that's a great question because there's a lot of speculation. Do you import your gang affiliations from the street to prison, or does it originate in prison? And we had no clue walking into this. We really had no idea of what this was going to be. What we found, though, was of all the people who were involved in gangs in prison, and that's about 20% of inmates in Texas, about half of them imported it from the street. The other half of them joined a gang for the first time in their life while they were incarcerated.
And was that for a sense of community? Was it a sense of safety that if you're part of this gang, you would at least have some type of safety within the prison system. I mean, why were people joining the gangs then when they became prisoners?
I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. What we already know about street gangs, these precepts that we know about street gangs also apply to prison gangs. Why 12, 13-year-olds join gangs? For status, for belonging, because of peer pressure and family. That also applied to prisons. But there was another component that we observed in prison that was distinct from what we see on the street, and that is ideology. So whether it's racial ideology, religious ideology, or just more generally about the group itself, they believe in what the group stands for. That was a different component that we observed. Again, we're talking about grown men here. We're not talking about preteens or teenagers. A lot of teenagers, you know, they don't wrap themselves up in an ideology like we'll see among grown men.
Well, give us a sense then of some of the gangs, because I think when people hear that, they think of the white supremacists, or mm-hmm. they think of some of the street gangs that have become notorious here in the US. Who did you encounter?
There are 12, what the Texas prison system calls security threat groups. And these groups are believed to have a strong organization, a hierarchy, like that's paramilitaristic. They have a propensity towards violence, and they have a long history of violence. So they're distinguished from the other 67 either cliques or street gangs that exist in that prison system. So there's a lot of variation across these groups. Some of them are very organized. But then some of them aren't. Some of them are more horizontally structured, and they're very decentralized leadership. So it's not like a top-down command that we see, whereas others, they do have that. And so if we're talking about the different types of groups, you have these notorious groups like the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas, the Mexican Mafia of Texas, the Texas Syndicate, Texas Mafia, like those types of groups. And then you have the cliques, which is a variety of street gangs, but then also what is the largest gang in the Texas prison system is known as the Tongos, where they don't have that hierarchical leadership in that organization.
How do those gangs then interact with the administrators? Or, you know, is there a level of control that they're trying to assert to either eliminate the gangs, if that's even possible? It doesn't seem to be, or to control them in a certain way. Like, mm-hmm. what is the relationship between the two?
Well, there are over 12,000 gang affiliates in the Texas prison system. That's larger than the entire inmate population, the custodial population in 21 other prison systems in the United States. These gangs have been in existence for about 4 decades. They're not going away. What's interesting, though, in Texas is no large major gang has formed since about 1990. So, like, the marketplace for new groups forming is essentially saturated. In terms of relationships with the actual administration, administration doesn't negotiate with gangs, and that's typical across all prison systems. That being said, there are back channels. There is information that's shared that goes from the line level. You know, think of your actual officers, your correctional officers. That is shared up to sergeants and lieutenants and so on. There is a security threat group management office, and they're responsible for gathering intelligence about gangs at prison admission. Every time, you know, that you have somebody move into the prison system, they're gathering intelligence because they're trying to keep the order in prison on the administrative side.
David Pyrouse will speak about his new book, Competing for Control, Gangs and the Social Order of Prisons. He'll be at the Boulder Bookstore this evening at 7:30 p.m. It is 8:29. You're listening to KGNU. Stay tuned for the Comment Line.
Hi, my name is Maura. I'm a listener from Denver. I just wanted to call and say that I'm so happy KGNU started broadcasting the show Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. I think I've been listening to the podcast for several years, and the analysis is always really on point, and I'm so happy that we have that now available over the air in Denver. So I just wanted to say thanks. Hopefully it stays on the air, and I'll keep listening.
And just to clarify, that show Loud and Clear was in fact broadcast as part of TUC Radio last Thursday afternoon. And that is the Comment Line. If you would like to leave a comment, you can call us at 303-447-9911 and leave a message, and we broadcast the Comment Line on Tuesday mornings here at KGNU. Well, tomorrow morning, we're going to dig in to this Supreme Court announcement that they are going to take up the case of the Colorado faithless electors. We're going to speak with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig. That'll be tomorrow morning at 8:35. Lessig has been supportive of the faithless electors. And in fact, he's been supportive of anybody in a state that wishes to cast a ballot as an elector going against the vote of the state. So we're going to dig into the case of the faithless electors. That's on tomorrow's A Public Affair at 8:35.